The Financial Times posts an article by a former head of the German Bundesbank about the future of the euro. He likens the currency situation to that of Tinkerbell in Peter Pan. There, the fairy is brought back to life when all the children in the world who believe in magic clap in unison. In Germany, however, the public and politicians are determinedly sitting on their hands. It is not that they do not believe in magic, rather they do not believe the other naughty children should benefit from the magic. They would rather the fairy die and teach the other children a lesson. Therefore, it is not a sentimental judgment to say that the currency may die from a want of love. The naughty children in this case being Greece. While the protesters fulminate fruitlessly through the streets, the country's future is being rewritten by the IMF. What are they going to do? Sell off national resources? Cut services? I'd guess most public sector workers will be fired. Pensions will be gone, taxes will double, and so on, until the books are balanced again. Meaning until the Germans get their money back, Ish says sardonically. The Greeks got huge development grants from the European Union, Jürgen insists. Many billions of euros which they used to build swimming pools on their roofs and have a 10-year tax holiday.
How do they persuade anyone to give them anything? Kevin asks. If their economy's so batshit crazy.
Porter blankly, Ish says. Kevin looks quizzical. The Greek government paid Blankley's old bank, Danforth Blauer, $300 million to fiddle the accounts and shift their debts out of sight, she explains. So on paper they look legit.
That was legal!
Danforth got their money, Ish says with a shrug. The EU are big boys, Jocelyn Lockhart says. If Danforth cooked the books, they should have spotted that for themselves.
Didn't the head of the EU also used to work for Danforth? I remember. Wheels within wheels.
But it's not our place to make moral judgments, only to forecast where this information will drive the market. Right now it resembles an enormous international game of keep away, with money taking flight from any company that so much as booked a junket to that side of the Mediterranean. But there is plenty of scope for things to get worse. A bet against togetherness is never a bad option, financially speaking. I come out of a meeting on Grand Canal Dock that afternoon to see I have missed a call from Paul. After a certain amount of debate with myself, I call him back. The phone is answered by a high voice.
Penico Sushin,
it says. Excuse me, I say.
What?
Says the voice. I realize I recognize it.
Remington?
The response is a loud thudding in my ear. Then in the background I hear Paul's voice say,
"Don't just throw it on the floor, Remington. Jesus."
And Remington's squeaky apology.
"What is Pinnacle Solutions?" I say when Paul picks up the phone.
"Our conversation the other day got me thinking," he says.
"Maybe we gave up on Hot Waitress too easily. I talked to Igor and we decided we'd put a few feelers out, see if it was worth having another try."
So, my worst fears have been realized.
I should send you a copy of the prospectus. I bet you know a lot of people who love to get in on the ground floor or something like this.
Hey! His voice becomes loud and sharp. If that paperclip gets stuck there, I'm not pulling it out!
Sorry, Claude. Where were we? You were interested in having a look at the prospectus?
No, I am simply returning your call, I say, although now I wish I hadn't.
Oh, right. Well, listen here, I've been pretty swamped with Hot Waitress the last few days, but I did find time to speak to your waitress friend this morning, and that whole mix-up the last time, that's all been squared away.
Squared away? I stop right there on the street. I feel a surge of omnidirectional gratitude, like a patient being given the all clear.
How did you manage that?
He laughs.
That's my job, right? Think of it as an editorial intervention.
What did you say to her?
It's not important what I said. The point is, if you want to try again with her, you can do it with a clean slate.
That is very good news, I say, and yet a sliver of doubt keeps niggling away at me.
Although, a clean slate, you cannot simply erase her memory.
I explained to her, that's all. I went in and casually brought you up and asked if she'd notice you
acting oddly lately. Then I told her you'd just been diagnosed as bipolar.
I stop again, this time without the all-consuming sense of well-being. Bipolar.
Yeah, when you think about it, it's really the only explanation that makes sense.
But...
For a moment, I can do little more than splutter.
But the whole point was to stop me from looking like a madman,
I manage at last.
How can you call it a blank slate if she thinks I am some kind of lunatic?
I said you were bipolar, not that you were a lunatic. Everybody's bipolar these days. It's practically a la mode. At the very least, it's not contagious. Or, wait, is it contagious?
This seems to me the exact opposite of a clean slate.
I'm telling you, Ariadne's fine about it, and from a narrative point of view, it's strong. Gives you a bit of edge, you know? So now we can move on to the next chapter. I've had a few ideas about what we might do.
Can it hurt to hear what he has to say?
Go on.
This time, instead of creating a whole new persona, I think we should work with what's there. Find out your good points and build on them. Now, the fact is that most of the qualities women look for in a man are the ones you don't have.
Are you tall? No. Are you handsome? I might not be the best judge, but I would have to say no. Are you brave? That would be a tough sell, given that the last time Ariadne saw you, you were fleeing in terror. But you do have one thing that sets you apart.
Wealth. I told you before, Ariadne isn't impressed by money, I say, with a certain amount of frustration. If she was, why would I need you?
I'm not saying you should go in there in a fur coat and stuff a 50 down her cleavage, but nobody's immune from money. It's a matter of how you present it.
Present it? I say, simultaneously suspicious and intrigued.
Wealth means money, and money means power. And power means transforming one situation into another situation. And waitresses, I've learned from my extensive research, are all waiting to be transformed. This one wants to be an actor. This one wants to be a dancer. This one wants to be a children's book illustrator. While you're sitting there eating your cheesecake and fantasizing about her, she's dreaming of the day someone gives her her big break.
Modern life is being somewhere else, I remember.
Exactly. Being a waitress is all about not being a waitress. Ariadne's a perfect example. She wants to paint, but she spends her days kowtowing to people who'd burn down the Louvre if they thought there was a book in it. She's crying out for someone to recognize her talent and set her free. That's where you and your money come in. Suddenly, you're not a grasping, malevolent banker anymore. You're a sensitive, art-loving, bipolar but not overly so Frenchman who wants to be her benefactor.
Her benefactor? I repeat, trying out the word. How would I become her benefactor?
Well, how about you tell her you're thinking of opening a gallery? A gallery devoted to feminist art. You want to exhibit her. In the meantime, you're going to bankroll her painting. She can't believe her ears. It's what she's been dreaming about all this time. The regular customer who reveals himself to be the guy with the magic wand. So she goes and paints. And for a while, you stay in the shadows being munificent and mysterious. But then, at last, you arrange to meet her and you confess that being around her amazing paintings has made you realise you've got all these other deeper feelings for her, which is practically true. You're just tweaking the chronology a little bit.
It sounds like I am paying her to love me, I say, flipping my ID at the transaction house security guard.
What are you talking about? It's a classic love story. Two people from different walks of life who realise they each hold the key to the other's dream. It's straight out of Hollywood.
But if your idea is that she will love me only because she feels obligated...
Grateful, Claude. Grateful. What's wrong with that? In many ways, it's like a traditional marriage. You protect her financially. She rewards you with love. Everybody wins.
I decide I can work on the moral mechanics later. The truth is that I am quite taken by his art gallery idea. But how would it work?
Don't worry about those details for now. That's all Act 2 stuff. Just buy her a few dinners, show her your checkbook, make encouraging noises, see how it goes. How the lift?
A tanned arm thrusts itself between the closing doors, followed by a patent leather pump with a charm bracelet dangling over it.
Hey, Claude!
Oh, you're on the phone, sorry. Slowly but inevitably, I feel myself turning bright pink as though Ish has caught me engaged in some crime.
Well, I say to Paul, that is most satisfactory. I will proceed as instructed and revert to you.
One more thing, Paul cuts in. She's going away.
Ariadne? I blurt, and then more quietly. For how long?
She told me she's going back to Greece for a fortnight. She's leaving tomorrow.
Tomorrow?
I blurt again. Beside me, Ish is examining her phone in the way one does when one is pretending not to be listening in.
Yeah, so look, I said you might call in just to put the whole you being mad thing to bed once and for all, but it'll need to be, actually, I suppose it'll have to be this afternoon.
How can I see her this afternoon?
I demand, feeling Ishi's eyes flick onto me and back again and experiencing a wave of irrational fury.
I don't know, call in for a muffin or something. You don't have to bring the benefactin up yet, or you could just advert to it.
Advert to it?
Yeah, you know, mention it in passing.
While I am explaining to her that I am bipolar, but in a good way.
Yeah, exactly.
I end the call. The lift eases to a halt and the doors glide open.
I didn't know you were bipolar,
Ish says as we step out. I'm not.
There's nothing wrong with it, Claude. My uncle Nick's bipolar. For a while there, he was convinced he was a koala bear. Used to hang off the satellite dish all day, thought it was a eucalyptus.
I'm not bipolar, I insist, and then, because I am too flustered and irritated to think of a plausible lie, that was Paul, I say.
All right.
Ish keeps a commendably straight face.
What did he want?
Ariadne's going away. He wants me to go and talk to her before she leaves. I groan, scrub my face with my hands.
It's all so ridiculous and embarrassing.
You must really like her to put in this much effort, Ish says neutrally. I do like her, I say, staring at my shoes. I don't know why it is so hard to tell her. I'm not 12 years old.
Ish looks at me for a moment.
It just is, Claude, she says. It just is. Then she glances at her watch.
Tell you what, though. If you want to see her at the cafe, you'd better get your skates on.
I look up at the clock on the wall of the research department. She's right. The Ark will be closing in a few minutes.
Maybe I should just wait till she comes back from her holidays.
No way, Claude. You got to seize the day with these things, Ish says firmly. Otherwise, they drag on and on and on.
But I have so much work.
You've been mooning over this girl for weeks. Just go and talk to her.
All right, all right.
With a swiftly deepening sense of unreality, as if it were water pouring into a leaking boat, I pull my coat back on and smooth down my hair.
Wish me luck.
You don't need luck, she says. But as I am waiting by the lifts, I hear her calling my name. I turn and see her hurrying towards me, in her hand a small porcelain jar.
What's that?
I was going through a crate of old stuff last night and I found it, she says, opening the jar and pouring into her palm a hillock of white powder. It's from Kokomoko. They call it Bila. If you inhale it, it's supposed to work as an aphrodisiac.
I thought you said I didn't need luck.
Go on, give it a go, just for a laugh. What you do is you blow it in her face like this. Oh, cripes, sorry, Claude.
Ah!
My eyes blaze.
God, oh God!
Through tears, I see a vaguely ish-shaped blur bounce fretfully around me.
I'm fine!
I gasp, feeling my throat begin to reopen.
Honestly!
I'm sorry, she says. Struth, I must have blown half the jar at you. Are you sure you're okay?
I think so.
Like you don't feel different or anything? Slowly her face comes back into focus, peering concernedly into mine.
I'm not sure, I admit. It's hard to tell.
Look into my eyes a second, Claude. Look into my eyes.
I think I am feeling better now. I don't know. You look a bit weird. Maybe you should leave Ariadne till tomorrow. She's going away tomorrow. All right, Ish says, still holding my gaze. I'd better go.
I decide, and turning, stumble for the lift. In the mirrored wall of the lift, I examine myself. Bila clings to my lapels and shoulders, glowing faintly like magical dandruff. I brush it away as best I can, though I can do nothing about my eyes, which are red and streaming, and instead of a sophisticated gallery owner, make me look authentically deranged. Nevertheless, as I descend, I feel exhilarated, transfigured as if I have found my way at last into Paul's unwritten book, waiting here all along at an invisible angle to the truth. The cafe is empty of customers, and in one corner the chairs have been lifted onto the tables.
We're just about to close,
the blonde waitress tells me.
I have a message for Ariadne,
I say. The girl goes to fetch her. A moment later, Ariadne emerges from the kitchen, carrot peelings stuck to her hands. What a thing to envy a carrot peeling.
Oh, it's you,
she says in what strikes me as a slightly louder voice than is necessary. Behind me, I sense her golden-haired colleague stop what she is doing in order to monitor the situation.
Yes,
I say, trying to maintain my composure over my pounding heartbeat, the Bila chattering in my veins.
I just wanted to...
But my attempt at an apology is exploded by a violent sneeze, and my apology for this first sneeze is overwhelmed by a second, even more violent, which ushers in a fit of minor sneezes and sneezelets. With a tsk of concern, Ariadne hurries over with a bouquet of paper tissues. Thank you. I dab at my eyes, which are streaming again.
You have a cold,
she chides, going behind the counter, then returning a moment later with a mug of herbal tea.
You boys are all the same. You don't take care of yourselves.
Thanks.
I sniff again, taking the mug. It seems Ish's aphrodisiac has played its part after all. My copious sneezing rules me out as any kind of threat, except as a disseminator of germs. I drink my tea, surreptitiously take in her dark beauty shimmering against the backdrop of the rain-teeming window. Everything is just as it should be. My line presents itself as if I have the page right in front of me.
About the other day.
Don't worry, Ariadne says. Your Dr. Cyrano has come in and explained everything.
Who?
Dr. Cyrano, the psychiatrist.
I roll my eyes, then realize this makes me look more bipolar.
Oh yes, of course.
He told me about this experimental drug you're taking that makes you act weird around women?
Yes, that's right, the experimental drug. However, I have stopped taking that now. In fact, I am completely cured.
Oh, that's great!
Yes, I wanted to let you know, and also to apologize if I alarmed you.
I pause, looking down at my knees mysteriously.
There was something else I wanted to ask you.
Oh? It relates to your paintings. She lights up.
You want to buy one?
It's a bit more complicated than that. If you have a few minutes, maybe we could...
She looks intrigued, but the noisy approach of a floor-polishing machine piloted by her blonde colleague restores her to reality.
Ah, but we are closing,
she laments.
Oh, I say then innocently... Maybe tomorrow would be better? Tomorrow I am going away, she says.
I see. I frown, then look at my watch. Perhaps a quick drink before you go home? I can't help being impressed by my own suaveness here. It's as if Ariadne is acting as a kind of catalyst in whose presence I am transforming into someone half worthy of her. Ariadne tucks her tongue thoughtfully against her palate.
I have something to do, she says. While you can come with me if you want, it is not so far.
Perfect, I say. The scene is unfolding just as I intended, although it is a surprise when she thrusts a large black garbage bag into my hands.
But,
she says enigmatically,
She whisks away into the kitchen and reappears behind a trolley, on top of which sits a large steel vat.
There's a couple of places we bring what we have left at the end of the day, she says.
Ah, I say, and then suavely, they are fortunate to get such excellent food.
I think leftovers is always tasting of leftovers, whatever they are. You coming?
I jump up and hold the door for her, then thrust open my umbrella and raise it above her head. In this manner, like some strange new creature of feet and wheels and umbrella spokes, we pass over the threshold of the ark and outside. Outside, where we are no longer waitress and customer, simply woman and man. Where as far as the world is concerned, we could be on a date, or lovers, or ecstatic newlyweds. We make our way over the plaza in the direction of the river. Ariadne is saying something, but I am too giddy to hear. This is happening. This is my life now. As we approach the quays, the rain dies away and we see, shattering the clouds, a glorious sunset strung across the water.
Oh, how beautiful,
croons Ariadne, coming to a halt. I just smile as if I had arranged it myself. Ariadne gazes happily at the sky's deep blush, then raises her finger and traces a kind of benediction in the air.
You know the artist Yves Klein?
She says.
When he is young, he lies on the beach and signs the sky with his finger. He says it was his first artwork.
A nice idea, I say. Though hard to fit in a gallery. She laughs. I seize my moment. Speaking of galleries, I begin and then stop. Ariadne has crossed the road and stepped onto the bridge.
Where are we going?
I ask, but she doesn't hear me over the rattling of the trolley. She couldn't be taking me to...
We're not going to... Are we?
But we are. The squalid tents, fewer in number than the last time I looked, are drenched with rain. Rainwater puddles in every available surface. On the improvised fence, rain-bleached posters blare grim statistics of government and bank collusion, with crudely rendered images of pigs in top hats smoking cigars and fist-squashing euro signs. A whiteboard importunes passers-by for things we need, followed by a list, tea bags, soap, batteries, and so on. Over the camp, a banner hangs, declaring damply, "First they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win." I feel some of my newfound suaveness escape into the cooling air. Ariadne opens a makeshift gate and wheels the trolley into the compound.
Hello!
She shouts, and again, until a dreadlocked head pokes out from one of the tents. His face, painted corpse grey and decorated with an array of sutures, breaks into a smile when he sees her. He scrambles out and to his feet.
Ah, you're a saint,
he says.
Just a few bits and pieces,
Ariadne says to him, handing over a bulging bag.
Mostly food from today, but there's a jar of coffee too, and some washing up liquid and other stuff.
Fantastic, the zombie says, beaming down into his trove, then nods at me.
Who's this?
This is Claude, Ariadne says, adding, to my mind unnecessarily,
he works in the bank.
Oh, yeah. The zombie draws back and examines me with a new attention. We are not part of this. I wave my hand at the protest signs, the skeletal ruin of Royal Irish. My bank is an investment bank, not a retail bank, and we haven't been given any government money. In fact, we have been punching above our weight.
Right. The zombie says, listen, I'm not here in the next couple of weeks.
Ariadne says to him,
but I tell Rika to keep bringing down something, okay?
You're going back to see your parents?
Aye, they tell me they are fine, but I can't help to worry. All this craziness, riots, petrol bombs, young people fighting the police every night. No trains, no food in the supermarkets, these lunatics who march around with swastikas, and meanwhile from Europe all they hear is, where's our money?
As she says this, her face quite changes, almost cracks open, revealing a dark, fretful interior I never knew existed. I feel a pang of guilt having advised many clients over the last year of the dangers of the Greek contagion, not to mention counseling Howie to short Greek bonds for all they were worth, which by the time he was finished was a lot less. Europe won't abandon Greece, I say, as much to reassure myself as Ariadne. There are mechanisms in place. People won't be allowed to starve. The mechanisms are only there to make sure the fat cats get their money back, the zombie interjects. Oh, this has happened before. The bankers lose the run of themselves, they bring the whole system crashing down, and then the people who have to pay to get it back on the rails are the ones on the very bottom. Then the CEOs give themselves a big fat raise for a job well done. That's not strictly accurate, I say. Latin America in the 1970s, he says. The banks lend a ton of money to a bunch of gangster dictators, thinking they'll make a packet. Then when all the loans turn bad and the US and Euro banks are on the point of tanking, the IMF steps in with emergency credit so these unfortunate countries can pay them back. But who pays back the IMF? The peasants, the farmers, the factory workers and the shoeshine boy. That's what happened in Tunisia, Russia, East Asia. That's just what's happening here. It's like this great big circle of debt with the only result that the people with the very least get poorer and poorer and poorer. The heat in his cheeks is visible through the corpse paint. Ariadne gazes at him pityingly, as if he had personally been chased up and down Patagonia by neoliberal economists. Look, I say, feeling my own cheeks turn red, it's not a conspiracy. The fact is, in Indonesia they got rid of food supports for the poor, the zombie interrupts. In Madagascar they cut the mosquito eradication program and 10,000 people died of malaria. The fact is, I persist, that Greece is deeply in debt. It can't afford to pay its workers. It can't afford to keep its electricity on. This is why the IMF is there, to stop the country from completely disintegrating. If they wanted to stop it disintegrating, they'd just cancel the debt, the zombie says. What are you talking about? Write it off. It's all imaginary anyway. Numbers on a piece of paper, so erase them. You have to pay back what you owe, I snap. That is the cornerstone of our civilization. Unless you're a bank, right? The zombie returns. Look at this place right here. He sweeps his hand at Royal Irish's grey facade. My grandchildren are going to be paying off the money they blew. My grandchildren are going to be born into debt because of them and their incompetence. And still the government's pumping them with more cash. Aha. Here I have the advantage of him. I feel my anger recede. My suaveness return. Not for much longer, I say. The bank will be wound down very shortly, and you and your friends can go home. That's not what I hear. What do you hear? I say sardonically. They're going to keep it open, the zombie says, throwing back a dreadlock. They're going to bring in new taxes so they can dredge up another few billion. They won't stop till we're in administration. The people won't let that happen. Ariadne comes in. They can't. This is Ireland. There's a lot of things people are willing to let happen. He seems to deflate, gestures gloomily at the rain-sodden tents. Half of our lot have given up in the last week. They think there's no point. Nobody's paying any attention. Aye, these guys are paying attention, Ariadne says, nodding across the street to where outside the defunct bank two enormous security guards have appeared, staring at the encampment with arms folded. They're there all the time, the zombie says. I think they work for the centre. So far they haven't crossed the road, although someone turned a water hose on us last night. All our stuff got soaked, the sleeping bags, the generator. Here, maybe you should head off, he says quickly as one of the guards starts speaking into a walkie-talkie. Leaning forward, he kisses her on the cheek. I'll see you when you get back. We are on our way at last. Though Ariadne keeps looking back fretfully, news of the sleeping bag soaking has given a gloss of martyrdom to the zombie sit-in. He's wrong about Royal Irish, I tell her. I just wrote a report for the government advising them to wind it down. It will probably be announced in the next few days.
How will they get their clothes and things dry in this rain?
Ariadne says. The beautiful sunset has gone, leaving a brooding gunmetal sky from which rain descends in fusillades. As we rattle back over the bridge, I review the situation. The zombie has taken the chapter in completely the wrong direction. I should never have let him speechify like that. I should never have let Ariadne go off-piste with the trolley. How can I get the story back on track? If only I had more Bila. We come back onto the IFSC side of the river, rumble northwards past boarded-up doors, broken windows, lowered shutters, roofless houses. We are probably only a couple of minutes from Transaction House as the crow flies, but my surroundings are quite unfamiliar.
This is where there used to be all the whores,
Ariadne says, seeming untroubled by the menacing ambiance.
When it's called Monto, you know the song?
Song?
They've taught it to me. Now when the Tsar of Russia and the King of Prussia landed in the Phoenix Park in a big balloon.
A fresh wave of paranoia rises up within me. Who is Dave? Is it the zombie or some other interloper?
In the 19th century, after the famine, there was no work and no food,
she is saying.
So all these women come here and sold their bodies to the British soldiers. They don't have another choice. Either they do it here or they get on a ship.
She gestures back in the direction of the river.
And sell it in America. It's funny, eh?
Is it?
Once is the biggest whorehouse in Europe, now is mostly turned into banks.
Oh, yes, I see. She bows her head, then says in a lower voice,
my mom told me that since the IMF came, there are all these girls every night at the end of our street getting into cars with strangers, girls I went to school with, some of them.
Right, I say blandly. This avenue of conversation does not seem promising, romantically speaking.
So there is still money to fuck them, I suppose.
I suppose there is.
It's so horrible what is happening there,
she says, suddenly passionate.
There are people starving everywhere you go, people starving. On the streets of the city where I grew up. And the world acts like we deserve it. We didn't drop cluster bombs on Baghdad. We didn't blow up hospitals in Gaza. Now because we don't pay back some loans, we are the worst in the world.
Trying to be optimistic, I tell myself that our misfiring encounter can't possibly get any worse. But now we arrive at our destination, I realize I am wrong. A straggling line of men stretches across the pavement. Some are slouched against the corroded wall, others slumped on the curb. Still others sprawled across the footpath, apparently asleep, so we have to steer the trolley around them. They are young and old, bald and hirsute, corpulent and lean as junkyard dogs. There are Roma men with tragic moustaches and pork pie hats, gaunt Slavs with chilly eyes, a couple of burly Africans murmuring to each other in French. The majority, though, from their features and accents, appear to be Irish. Men with wild sailor beards and bulbous capillaried noses, cans of beer in toxic colours, skeletal, shiftless men with pinhead pupils. Sheepish men, better dressed than the others, who chew their gum, clear their throats and study their phones as though it were a connecting flight they were waiting for. A palpable quickening runs through the line as Ariadne passes along it. Some of the men leer, a few of them address her not by name, more in the spirit of, there she is now, how ye gorgeous, as well as a less articulate array of grunts and gurns. We make it around the corner without incident, but then in a narrow lane one particularly sordid specimen lurches up and grabs her by the arm. Feverishly, I try to remember the tiger throw Marco taught us in the Transaction House gym, then realize the creature just wants to show her an abscess on his leg, which Ariadne tuts over sympathetically before going through a door. We have entered a low, poorly lit hall. Men and the occasional woman sit eating at rickety trestle tables or queue with their trays at the far end where food sweats unappetizingly under heat lamps. A dour fellow in a hairnet comes out from behind the counter and greets Ariadne. Thanks, he says curtly, taking the trolley from her and parking it by the hatch.
How are things, Brendan?
Ariadne asks.
How are they ever? Miss Brendan responds.
He pauses, directing an unabashedly hostile look at me.
Even you help her? His name is Claude,
Ariadne says.
I've kidnapped him to show him how the other half live.
This is the Crawley Street shelter, I say, realizing where I am. My bank has done some fundraisers for you. Raffles, fun runs, that sort of thing. Of course, Brendan exclaims. It's thanks to you we've been able to open our east wing. He points behind him, though all I can see is a blank wall.
Hi, Brendan,
Ariadne scolds. No offense, he says, the choleric blaze in his eyes belying the words. But you people have a lot to answer for. When there was money everywhere, no one wanted to know about this place because we didn't fit the big success story. Now the country's broke, they tell us there's nothing left for us. Then next thing you hear, they're giving billions to the banks. He is trembling now. Ariadne lays a soft hand on his shoulder.
Calm down, she says. What's the use to get angry?
Sorry, the hair-netted man says bluntly. Then, turning on his heel, he mumbles, I'll go and get yesterday's vat for you. He stumps back to the kitchen, leaving Ariadne and me in a slightly strained silence, broken sporadically by bloodthirsty cries from the surrounding tables. He is not normally like this, Ariadne says.
It's fine,
I say. As I said, my bank is an investment bank, not a retail bank, so we are not the ones who receive these handouts he's talking about.
I meant I hope he is all right.
Oh yes, of course. A noise comes from outside, a chorus of angry voices and a series of thuds. Brendan, who is wheeling out the scrubbed clean double of the vat we just delivered, thrusts it aside and runs to the door where a large black SUV has pulled up. Its appearance seems to have enraged the men waiting in line. They have surrounded the vehicle and are rocking it on its wheels, thumping the doors and windows while yelling abuse at the driver, a frightened-looking woman who has a small child in the back seat. Brendan wades into the crowd, tugging bodies away and shoving them back. Lads, lads! He shouts. With a screech of its wheels, the SUV promptly reverses and manages to make it back out through the crowd, though not without more kicks and a few goblets of spit adorning the shining bodywork.
What's she doing coming here?
A small, outraged man demands of Brendan.
What's she doing in a fucking yoke like that?
Go in and have your food and stop annoying people, Brendan tells him. Then, to us, he says, her husband went bust. He's done a legger. Banks kicked her out of the house. She and the kid have been living in that car for 2 weeks. He gazes bleakly into the cloud-mobbed sky for a moment. This place is fucked, he says, and without further comment returns inside. We turn back towards the river. I tilt the umbrella against the newly pugnacious wind. Ariadne has fallen silent, although the nature of her thoughts do not remain a mystery for long.
These fucking banks, she exclaims, and then, sorry, you work in one, I keep forgetting.
No, you're right. Some banks acted very badly, I concur.
But I know your bank is an investment bank, not a retail bank.
I wasn't going to say that. In fact, I was going to say it, but I also wanted to steer her around to the idea that bankers are capable of doing good. Many corporates, as well as creating employment and contributing to GDP, do have significant charity programs.
Right, with the fun runs.
Yes, but we also donate a percentage of profits to charity every year.
As a tax write-off.
Well, that is not a primary reason.
The only reason you do anything is money. Cheap tax, that's why all of you are here.
That's a bit... But she cuts me off.
You think if the Irish government turns around and says, we are putting up the tax, but we guarantee every penny can go directly to the people who need it the most, the schools and hospitals and homeless shelters, you think any of these companies will stay?
Well, you see, a business has a legal obligation to its shareholders.
Oh yes, just following orders. Where do I hear that before?
Is she serious? Is she genuinely comparing investment banks to Nazi war criminals?
I am not saying they are the same.
Ariadne's cheeks are pink, and as she speaks, she gesticulates vigorously with both hands so that the trolley is unpiloted and is stopped from crashing off the curb only by my shins.
I am saying that once they have an excuse, people will do anything.
They do
what they are told, and they take their money, and they think it's all okay because it's just their job. While their real self is what happens after work, when they're bouncing a baby on the knee or writing poems about snowflakes or whatever.
The trolley heads for my shins again. I am too despondent to get out of the way.
Here I am with the woman of my dreams, and I feel more like I'm having a shouting match with my father. We push on, silent again, save for the metallic yammer of the trolley. There is no food left to deliver, meaning we are on our way back to the Ark. A part of me is glad. Cyrano himself might have trouble reviving this scene. For the sake of closure, however, I say,
"Let's talk about your work."
Ariadne scowls, as if I have proposed we go to the dentist and have all her teeth extracted. Pretending I haven't seen, I go on,
"I must tell you, I admire your paintings very much. I think they are very beautiful, and that they deserve a wider audience. I would like to help you if I can."
She doesn't respond. The trolley, which I suspect she is deliberately pushing over the bumpiest sections of the pavement, clatters unencouragingly.
"Firstly, I want to exhibit them in a proper gallery," I persist. "Perhaps hire a space that exists, perhaps find somewhere entirely new. Also, I would like to offer you financial assistance so you can concentrate on painting full-time without having to do menial work."
"Menial work?"
"The cafe waitressing."
"Oh," she says. For a long time, it looks like this is the full extent of her thoughts. "That's very interesting," she says at last. "I am happy you like my paintings."
"And?"
"What you are saying, you want to be my patron?"
"Is it a bad thing? The greatest artists had patrons, Leonardo, Velázquez. Today the big banks sponsor a lot of the major art fairs, as well as buying a great deal of the work."
"Yes, alternative assets, that's what you call art, isn't it? It's a good source of tax relief."
I don't reply. What is there to say?
"Did you always want to be a banker?"
she asks sadly.
"Not particularly,"
I say. "In college, I studied philosophy. Nietzsche, Foucault, Texier." As if I have pronounced a secret code word, her head whips round and she comes to an abrupt stop.
"Texier? You mean François Texier?"
"Well, yes," I say. "From Paris, he died a couple of years ago."
"So, now we can talk," she says. "Because you know Texier is my great hero."
Now it's my turn to come to a halt. Can it be true? Was Paul right all along?
"You have read his philosophy?"
"A little bit. I read what he wrote about financial capitalism. He is very critical. How do you manage to go from Texier to banking?"
"It wasn't something I planned.
Anyway, you know he became a painter late in his life."
Seeing my confusion, she explains.
"When he is quite old, he becomes disillusioned with philosophy. Philosophy, science, religion, they all start by saying they will tell you the truth, and from there they lead only to bigger and bigger lies. But art is different, because art tells you right at the start, 'Okay, I'm going to tell you a whole lot of bullshit here.' Texier says that in modern times the only one we can still believe is the man who tells us he is lying. And so he gives up philosophy and he starts to paint."
"I don't think I have ever seen any of his paintings."
"Oh, Claude, they are so beautiful."
She seizes my arm. Her countenance has quite changed, become rapturous and light-filled.
"Strange, you know, and dark. But when I see them, I feel like my heart is going to explode. One little canvas this big makes you remember just how huge and weird the world is. And how fucking amazing it is to be here in it."
I smile. It has been a long time since I felt like that.
"And he has all these interesting ideas. For example, he wouldn't ever sell his paintings. He only gives them to friends because he thinks that when you sell them, the meaning changes. They start to become the false truth that he is trying to escape. But he can't control it. Eventually the friends sell them, or they die, and their children sell them. Anyway, they finish up with the price tag. And in the end, he gives up painting too, because he thinks that art is only making things worse."
"But you," I say, "you don't feel like that, do you?"
She frowns, sighs, stops with her trolley in the middle of the path.
"He's very interesting. When I come here first, he's because I want to be a painter. I hear there's a boom, Celtic Tiger, and
when I get here is so exciting, so much energy in the air, everyone talking about the future and progress and all that. Very different from Greece, where, you know, everyone has a name from a myth of 3,000 years ago. And the best thing, the art market is so crazy back then, even someone like me can sell paintings. But after a little while, I start to realize the people who come to the galleries, they are not even looking at the paintings. They're just in a race with each other to buy it. Paying all this money, you know, the most expensive piece always sell the first, so they can belong in this special club. And at the same time, I'm working in the cafe. I'm coming down here every day, this fucking street. She waves her hand. I look around at the litter-strewn gutters, the weed-split paving stones, the tenements doomed for the wrecking ball. Every time I come here, it's a little bit worse. Even with all this money, no one sees it. No one does nothing to change it. And it takes me a time to realize no one wants to see it. That's what this whole boom is about, is so people don't have to see things. All the fucked up stuff that is happening or has happened in the past, they cover it up with money, with talk about the future, with new buildings, with drinking, whatever. But the boom is over, I say. Yes, and now the very same thing is happening again. Everybody tries to forget what they did during the boom. Everybody acts instead like they are the victim. You know, the Greek word for truth is aletheia. Lethe, this is the river of forgetting. So the truth, aletheia, is that which you don't forget. But here, it's like the total opposite. The truth is what you don't remember.
Lethe or lethe, I say, recalling the old argument about the Radiohead song.
It's like this whole country is trying to crawl out of its own skin, she says. And I start to feel that me, with my art, I am helping them.
But you can paint whatever you want to paint, I tell her. You can paint nothing but these streets if you want. I'll make sure the whole world sees them.
Yes, that is exactly the kind of fucking thing art would do, she laughs. And show it in a gallery far away from here where you can't smell the smell and no one going to stab you with a HIV needle and people can say, oh, how sad, yet how beautiful. Then it get bought by some yuppie with a polka dot tie. Or look at this one.
We have arrived back on the quays. Directly in front of us stands a tall sculpture depicting, in blackened bronze, six emaciated humanoids and a little bronze dog. It's a famine memorial, you know. A million people died in this tiny little country. And millions more left on ships that went from right here, and they never come back. So from a terrible thing that really happened on this spot, we get 100 and how many years later, a piece of art, very beautiful, that people can look at as they hurry by with their takeaway lattes.
I don't think I have ever looked at it before, with or without latte. I step up to the sculpture, run my finger down the tortured cheek of one of the gaunt, inconsolable forms. It is beautiful, I say, not knowing whether I am contradicting her or not. Now look down, she says. I do as she says, and see that although the figures themselves are anonymous, names have been printed on the stylized bronze cobblestones beneath their bare feet. Names of companies, names of banks, names of individuals, the corporate and private sponsors who paid for the work. Billionaires, businessmen, a disgraced prime minister, a society hostess, others I recognize from newspaper accounts of deals and court cases, corruption charges that were never proved. So ask yourself, who does this artwork want you to remember? I step back with a chill. The wind pulls and chafes at the surface of the river. On the far side, the night sky is reflected and intensified in the lowering windows of the corporate towers, as though they were mining darkness from the air, storing it within them. Maybe in 100 years some artist will make a sculpture of the old woman in Athens looking through the garbage for something to eat, Ariadne says, resting her cheek against the cold metal shoulder of a peasant. And passers-by will stop their rocket packs to film it with their magic future phones, and they'll think how beautiful, how sad.
So you've given up on art? I say, in summary. You're turning down my offer?
I haven't given up on anything, she says. And you are very kind to make me this offer, but I like working in the cafe, making a space where people can come together and feel safe and good. For me, it's not menial work. Even if they're bankers, maybe if they eat a nice home-cooked food that's made with love, I could change how they think a little bit, and afterwards I could bring the leftovers to the shelter, and at nighttime I could paint my paintings, and if anyone wants to buy them, they can. They're not very expensive. What does it mean to become a famous artist, anyway? That your paintings cost more money, right? That's all it means, deep down. But why should rich people have all the beauty?
Not all the beauty. I qualify, wistfully taking in her dark radiance, the twin lights in her eyes. She holds my gaze a moment, then looks away.
I have made enough escaping. Now I am here. I want to be here.
Though you are going back to Greece, I remind her. My father is very sick, she says, and everything is so fucked up over there right now that in the hospital there is no food or medicine, so your family has to bring them for you, if you have a family.
She hoists her shoulders as if shrugging off a cold and sodden cloak.
Do you go back home often? Are they still in Paris, your parents?
No, they died.
I'm sorry.
She has separated herself from the statue and comes towards me. She wraps the black cloth of my suit between her finger and thumb.
It was recent.
I shrug. Her hand remains on my arm. In the dusk, her green eyes are dark pools in which the reflected streetlights swim like lilies.
So you are alone,
she says. The wind swirls down the river. The quayside traffic judders like a heavier earthbound wind. Everything seems to liquefy as if something had broken open. I realize my story is at a turning point. The subterfuge, the plotting, the misdirection, all of that falls away, and the dull detail of my life here too, the whole maze tumbling into itself like panels of scenery. The lie has brought me, as promised, to the truth.
Look, I begin.
But that is as far as I get. Ariadne's phone has started to ring.
Sorry, one second,
she says, holding up a finger to suspend our conversation, like a fairy bringing time to a halt with a twitch of her wand, then unleashes into the phone a torrent of accelerated Greek. Sequestered within the alien noise, my mind is racing. Am I actually going to do this? Should I talk to Paul first? But the time for Cyrano's and surveillance equipment has passed. I have been in a story long enough, trapped on a flat page, delivering lines written by others. Now is the time to step out into the world. How else could this end but with a hero speaking in his own voice? Ariadne gives me a wrapping up sign. I take a deep breath, I gird my loins. Then, into the phone, I hear her say,
Sagapo, Oscar, Sagapo, I love you, baby, I'll be home soon.
And around me it seems that 100 doors and windows have been flung open, as in some stuffy room, and all of the potential, the dreams, the imagined future is borne away in an instant, like banknotes thrown to the wind.
And what did you say?
What could I say?
Didn't you ask her who it was?
No, I simply ignored it and then continued my pretense that I had approached her only out of an interest in her work.
And that was it. Then you just went back to the office.
First I bought a painting, Simulacrum 103. There it is, by the mantelpiece. I point to the painting, still in a cardboard box, like a cold avant-garde pizza. Paul opens the lid, winces, closes it again. At the breakfast bar, Igor, who arrived uninvited with Paul, tosses pistachio nuts into his mouth and flips the shells on the ground.
Let me get this straight, Paul says. The two of you are getting on fine. Everything's going according to plan. Then she gets this phone call during which she says,
I love you, Oscar. I'll be home soon.
That's all?
The rest was in Greek.
Well then! Paul spreads his hands expansively. She could have been talking to anybody. Her uncle, her brother, the guy who's come to fix the fridge. You know these Mediterraneans, they're very demonstrative.
It wasn't the man who comes to fix the fridge, I say, recalling that light that jumped in her eyes as soon as she took out her phone. She meant what she said.
Who is he, then? Who is Oscar?
Who is Oscar? Since that moment at the waterside, when my dreams were so casually atomized, I have thought of little else. In my imagination, he keeps changing, one moment garrulous and witty, the next silent and serious. Right now, I picture him as a handsome, athletic type, tanned, stubbled, a pilot for Médecins Sans Frontières, who in his spare time writes surprisingly tender poetry. The others have differing opinions. Paul sees him as a brilliant entrepreneur, a wild-eyed maverick making a fortune from imperceptible flaws in the system. Igor proposes that he is a professional sex worker, with Wang like the extinguisher of fires, who has made her addict to his sex, and she cannot stop sexing him.
See, with a high-quality waitress surveillance system, there'd be none of this ambiguity,
Paul says, frowning.
Without knowing what we're up against, it's hard to work out the best course of action.
Only one course,
Igor says.
Good old-fashioned maiming. Without this monster Wang of his, she will soon turn elsewhere for her pleasures.
I don't think it will make a difference, I say. The writing was on the wall long before she mentioned Oscar. She hates banks with a passion.
But we expected that, right?
Paul says.
That's why we were pushing the benefactor thing. Didn't she go for that at all?
She seemed uncomfortable taking money for her art from someone who works in a bank. She likened us to Nazis. He sighs.
Okay, well, you're right. Once a woman starts calling you a Nazi, it's time to bow out. Frankly, from what you told me, you may have dodged a bullet.
The paintings and the organic food should have been a clear enough warning. Better to get out now before she starts making you wear vegetarian shoes and calling history her story.
And leave her tampons all over the place.
Igor chimes in warily.
That is what happens with my ex-wife. Tampons everywhere in my house. She tried to unionize the strippers. Man who says, we must educate the women, I say to him, you think anybody pay to see strippers who have cut off their hair and now dress in boiler suits that they will not take off?
Igor here actually owned his own strip club back in the old country. Paul explains.
Happier times. Happier times.
Igor says mistily.
Anyhow, the main thing now is that we put Ariadne behind us and get you back in the game.
Paul says, bending down to his bag.
If you'll take a look at the laptop here, you'll see the beta version of the new hot waitress. We're still updating the database, but there are plenty of options.
I appreciate your help, I say, but for me, I think the game is over.
Over?
Paul looks up from the laptop with a start.
What do you mean?
I rise from my chair and go to the window. Uninhabited office blocks blaze with light against the dark sky. A ghost armada sailing the black ocean.
I suppose I don't feel like I dodged a bullet,
I say. I think the bullet went right through me.
Then why stop?
Paul says, jumping to his feet.
We can find out more about Oscar. Maybe there are cracks in the relationship we can exploit. We'll redesign you from the ground up, so whatever Oscar lacks, you have in spades.
I smile. When I asked him to come over, I still thought there was something he could do. Now I could see that the very fact I'm having these conversations shows how hopeless the situation is. Tricks, artifice, the implacable double agency of money. This is my world, not Ariadne's, and there is simply no way to go from mine to hers.
Artifice is everybody's world. You think Ariadne gets out of bed looking like that? You think she doesn't put in her time in front of the mirror getting her beautiful ebony hair to flow just so?
Look, you've had a disappointment. I understand that. But a few weeks ago, you didn't even know her.
What's to stop you having the same feelings for somebody else?
Take a look in our database. He holds the laptop open for me, faces arrayed on the screen like chocolates in a box.
There are literally hundreds of other waitresses here. Just take a look.
No.
Look, that's all I'm asking. I don't want anybody else, I say.
Paul sighs. Okay, Claude, it's your decision, of course. But if you don't mind me saying so, you're being awfully naive about this. Ariadne made an impression on you, and that's great. But life is not literature. Sooner or later, the spell wears off. The romantic feelings disappear, and you're left watching somebody's body disintegrate. You start with a love story. You end up manacled to an hourglass, watching the sands run out.
It is true. Igor concurs with a voice gravelly with regret. When I marry my wife, she is filthiest lap dancer in all of Transnistrian Autonomous Region. There are criminals who come out of her stall weeping with shame at the things she has done to them in there. When she chooses me, I am joyous as priest in orphanage. But the day we are married, it is like someone steal her away and replace her with her mother. Shoutings, hitting me with rolling pin, meeting other women to form terror gangs of feminism. Last time I see her, she tell me she want to have breast reduction surgery. I ask her, are you mad? God and plastic surgeon have give you best boobs in former Soviet Union. Why do you throw this gift? She will not listen. I cannot bear to see this tragedy, so I come here to begin new life.
He gazes bleakly into his glass.
She must be 15 now,
he says.
What we're offering you here is freedom from that,
Paul says, brandishing the laptop again.
Don't you understand? That's what Hot Waitress is. A way to stay inside the story forever. I understand what he's offering me.
A chance to keep paying him a retainer indefinitely, but I am tired of being his mark. I think this is goodbye, I say. Scowling, he puts the laptop away, takes his coat from the back of the chair. Why don't you stay inside the story? I challenge him, if everything is better there. It's too late for me, he says. I have a wife, remember? You have an hourglass you're chained to, I say. You've already abandoned your career. If you don't love your wife anymore, why don't you leave her too? You really don't understand anything, do you? He says. I read somewhere that money kills your ability to empathize. I flinch. He opens the door. I do love her, he says. That's the whole problem. He turns away, repeating to himself. That's the whole problem. 3. Persona ficta. In societies where modern conditions of production prevail, all of life presents itself as an immense accumulation of spectacles. Everything that was directly lived has moved away into a representation. Guy Debord. It's true. Texier said some harsh things about the banks. This, in fact, was putting it mildly. He saw the financial market, with its obsessive will to quantification, as the perfect instance of his totalizing system, his eutrophication or veil of Maya, a web of abstractions so complicated that it asphyxiated what it was supposed to explain before collapsing inevitably under its own weight. The artificial, the less than real, was once conceived as a kind of hell, he wrote. Yet today, the less than real is prized more than gold, and the quaint stuff of the tangible, the underlying, as it has become known, exists only as raw material for new and lucrative abstractions. The financial corporation has become a machine for producing unreality. Why do we desire this unreality? Why do we model ourselves on this machine? We know that what we call the corporation, Texier wrote, first appeared in Europe's Middle Ages, signed into law by the Pope in AD 1250. It was conceived as a legal persona ficta, a fictive person that had many of the attributes of a real person. It was capable of owning property, for example, of suing and being sued. At the same time, it was bodiless, invisible, free from human infirmity and the ravages of time. Conceived as such, the corporation was almost identical to contemporary ideas of angels. According to medieval religious doctrine, angels too were immaterial, ageless, capable of acting like human beings, but bound by neither substance nor time.
The corporation, an entity which we imagine as a uniquely secular creation, a paragon of reason and common sense, in fact began its life as an offshoot of a Christian myth. Today, though we no longer believe in angels, we still regard the corporation as a higher order of being. It is composed of ordinary people, but it transcends them. Semi-divine, it floats above our messy and contingent reality. Of all the corporations, it is the bank, which produces nothing tangible, which trades only ever in the virtual, that remains closest to pure spirit, and thus sits at the top of the hierarchy, equivalent to the thrones and dominions. Whatever it does, we are ready to forgive. Or rather, we assume that what we see as sins are instead mystical transactions beyond our understanding. We have an instinctive feeling that these dark angels, of us and yet above us, must be protected and appeased to the extent that we allow them to predate on the material world, feed vampirically off our very reality, leaving us to live among their detritus. We do this because we want to be like them, because we ourselves aspire to the condition of persona ficta, free from reality's contingencies and humiliations, insubstantial, unchanging, inviolable, endlessly apart. Yet how does a person become a persona ficta? How can one simultaneously turn fully inwards and make oneself abstract? Perhaps these two operations are less exclusive than we might think. Humans have always used stories to order reality. Now, however, technology allows unprecedented quantities of reality to be turned into story. Reality thereby becomes secondary. Just as the banks use the underlying only for what can be derived from it, life becomes merely raw material for our own narratives. The building block of these narratives is the image. The image operates by delimiting reality, placing boundaries around it, removing its connections and context, in short, by enslaving it. It presents the results, however, as a concentration or apotheosis of reality. The image is the derivative of the self. Can it be mere chance that the rise of financial capitalism has coincided with the proliferation and incorporation of the camera into almost every facet of the Western world? The camera's promise is that the moment can be subordinated, deferred, stored, experienced at our leisure. Life and the living of it have, for the first time in history, become separate. In recording our own reality, that is, in simultaneously experiencing and deferring experience, we pass from the actual into the virtual. Every age dreams of defeating death. This is our chosen method. By hoarding images, we seek to conquer time. Of course, we do not mistake a photograph in a frame or on a screen for the reality as it was. Nevertheless, as Barthes has written, the photograph makes an assertion, and it makes it in a particular mode, what the Greeks called an aorist, a form of the past tense that is never actually completed but seems to go on indefinitely. Thus, the picture presents us with the past as a continuum which flows parallel to the present, but flows statically, a frozen river, so we may examine it at any point in the future. It is this imagined future self, looking at the pictures of the past, that is the true product of the camera. Although technology has the capability now to record entire lifetimes, meaning that every moment may be pulled from the foaming sea of oblivion to the dry land of perfect recall, the mythic power of the photograph nevertheless relates to the future and not to the past. Every recording conceals the secret fantasy of a future self who will observe it. This future self is himself the simulacrum, the persona ficta. He exists beyond time, beyond action, beyond need. His only function is to witness the continuum of the past, as he might observe the steps that brought him to godhood. Through this fantasy, time is transformed from the condition of loss into a commodity that may be acquired and stockpiled. Rather than disappear ceaselessly into the past, life accumulates, each moment becoming a unit of a total self that is the culmination of our experiences in a way that we, biological composites who profligately shed our cells, our memories, and our possessions, can never be. And this fantasy self, or persona ficta, is the soul, as conceived by a materialist people. He is the apotheosis of the individual, arrogating reality to himself, just as the bank does with its totalizing abstraction. Who is with us in this recursive heaven where time has been defeated? No one. The modern heaven is one of perfect isolation. We are not there either. The transcendental or sempiternal self bends over his screen in correspondence with a forever echoing past, leaving a present that is closed off, superfluous, from which, and this is the real meaning of the fantasy, we are exempted. That is our transcendence of death, to achieve a death in life, a stasis, a replacement of ourselves with a duplicate whose only function is to relay the past to the future, to conquer loss with a virtual repleteness, to extinguish the present by making ourselves comprehensively elsewhere.